This is Japan Baseball Weekly. News, interviews, analysis, and your questions, all about NPB. And now your hosts, Johnny Gibson and Jin Allen.
Hi, and welcome to the Japan Baseball Weekly podcast. It's for the week of August 19th. I'm John Gibson, and with me on a Saturday evening for me and a Sunday morning in Japan is my buddy Jim Allen. What's up, dude?
I'm here, and you're not. And I'm sad because of that.
Well, no hitters yet, though. So.
Yeah, that is a thing. And the other thing is typically we have no hitters when I'm not writing the story for the day job. That's not true. That's not true, but half of them, I suppose.
So yeah, you don't want no hitters on your watch, and I want to watch no hitters. So
I see. Well, good... people who follow me on the thing that should be known as Twitter and not Y is knows that my favorite hit of the game is the first one.
I love it. I love it.
Because I'm lazy. Mind you, if I'm at the game, that's different. But no, in the office, it's just, I was going to do something else. Go away. I like my routine, and no hitters are not routine. So, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, all right. Go away. All right. Well, it hasn't happened yet. So we've got a few more opportunities. So anyway, on this stop week's it. Show, don't say that. We've got a chat with Kyle Keller of the Yomiuri Giants. We go rocking with Roki, and we've got some other items, and then we're going to handle some high heat. So let's start swinging.
Clearing the bases.
All right. So the finale of the trilogy of my July 15th weekend trip to Tokyo Dome. This was Hanshin, during which that 3-day weekend, I got three interviews, two on one day. And this one was Kyle Keller, formerly of the Hanshin Tigers, in a game versus the Hanshin Tigers. So that was fun. And I got to talk with the right-handed reliever. He spent two seasons with the Tigers and pitched okay. And then the Giants had picked him up this season, and he closed out his first save with the Giants. I think it was the night before I left on this trip. He tossed a 1-2-3 ninth inning, had a couple of strikeouts in a 1-0 game. So it wasn't like they just threw him out there in any old game. It was against his former team. It was 1-0. Any mistakes could cost you a lot there. So that showed some trust. And obviously, here's a guy who pitched for the Tigers, and you'll hear him say, or I'm not sure if it was on the interview or not, because we talked a lot and this was a long time ago, but he did talk about things just not working out, you know. And I don't know if that's code for they weren't, you know, the team wasn't willing to meet my demands, or I think I was worth more than that, or they tried to lowball me and reduce my salary. I don't know what that means, and I won't claim to know. I just know that things didn't work out and they ended up parting ways. But he has really pitched well for the Giants in a limited role in the bullpen. We haven't seen him out there closing games a lot. There are opportunities, I would think, you know, here's a good opportunity for Keller, but we don't know, again, who needs X amount of rest, who pitches or thrives better in certain situations. I just know that Keller's pitched really well at Tokyo Dome. And I did do a story about that, so please look it up. You'll get an opportunity to see just how well he has pitched at Tokyo Dome. And striking out a lot of guys, not allowing runs. And I'm not sure if that's what the role that Shinnosuke Abe, the first-year manager, has for him, just letting him pitch in that setting. And you'll hear Kyle talk about the fact that he likes the Dome. He likes that that mound. And it was a really nice chat, so let's take a listen. All right, so we'll start here. Now, how do you like pitching for the Giants?
I love it. No, it's obviously good that I was already used to, you know, Japanese baseball for 2 years playing with Tigers, but I feel like I've settled in pretty nicely and I've been enjoying it.
How did you end up moving?
It was just kind of, you know, by chance, you know, not really any reason or rhyme or reason to it.
Sometimes that happens?
Yeah, sometimes it happens, you know, so.
Now, you pitched in Japan with the Tigers, and now you're pitching with the Giants. What's the biggest difference you feel in the organizations or the fan base or the media pressure and all that stuff? What do you feel?
I don't really find too much difference. I feel like they're two of the more popular teams, you know, two of the better teams. And I feel like there's not too much difference, you know. I kind of just try to approach the same way. I come out and go about my business and work hard every day. And I've had the pleasure of playing for two really good teams here, so I've been enjoying it.
How much does that get to you, or how much do you see of it? Like the TV commentary and the newspaper stuff and the fans yelling and all that stuff?
I don't see too much of the TV and newspaper stuff just because of my language difficulties.
It's easy to hide, yeah.
I can stay away from that pretty good, but I mean, you can feel every game. You can feel how much it means to the fans, how much it means to the team. So, yeah, I mean, you can feel it, and but it's a good thing, you know.
Yeah, I certainly agree. I know it's a pleasure to play. That's what the players tell us all the time. And, you know, no matter how much the fans want you to win, the players want to win more.
Exactly.
Yeah. So now you came from an all-dirt infield, and now you're playing mostly on an artificial turf infield. How's that changed for you?
Not too much change either. The visual is a little different.
For you, on the mound?
Yeah, on the mound, the visual-wise. Just because coming to the Tigers, the all-dirt visual, just nothing but dirt between me and the plate. It's a little different, but I got used to that. And now, you know, this is more of what I'm used to, you know, mound, green, then dirt. So, you know, it took a little bit getting used to just, you know, pitching on my home mound. But now that I'm used to it, I love this mound. I've always have loved this mound. I feel like I've pitched well for 2 years here. So, you know, I love it. So it's not too much different. Visually a little bit.
Yeah, I want to go back to the mound and then green and then dirt before you get to the plate. Do you have to adjust your vision, or how do you actually adjust the pitching on those types of mounds versus all dirt?
It's not really, there's no really adjustment. It's just, I just feel like when I first got the cushion, my eyes were used to the, you know, the green in front of me, and it was just more visually appealing to me. When I got to the Tigers with the dirt infield, not that there was any adjustment, it just, it didn't look the same. So I mean, it just took one or two times pitching on it, which was in the preseason, so it's fine, but it wasn't really an adjustment. It was just which really shouldn't matter if it's visually appealing or not, but that's really the only thing that was different, was just like standing up there like, wow, this looks different than any other time I've pitched in the last, you know, 15 years.
So, gotcha. All right, now, there's so many variables in Japan. You got the different mounds, you got dome stadiums, and I talked to a guy the other day, he said he had never pitched in a dome before until he came to Japan. So how do you experience all those differences and variables?
Yeah, there are a lot of variables. You know, outside, inside, turf, grass, dirt. As a pitcher, you know, you can't really control them. You just try to, you know, do the same thing wherever you're at. But some of the stadiums are smaller. Some of the stadiums are bigger. Koshan, you know, is one of the bigger ones. So I guess really the only thing, you can kind of play to the park sometimes. Some of the turf fields are faster. So, you know, you got to watch out for the hard ground balls getting through, as opposed to a place like Mazda Zoom Zoom, which is a little bit slower with the grass infield, so I feel like less base hits get through. And then as far as stadium size, sometimes, you know, you gotta play to some fly balls or leave Jingu in a hurry if you know, if you're not careful.
Yes.
But then a place like Goshen, a lot of those balls are staying in the park, so you don't really try to change too much, just something you think about before and, you know, keep in the back of your mind. But I don't really try to change too much park to park, but there are a lot of variables, you are correct.
Yeah. Now, how do you feel about going up against your first team in Japan when you guys face them?
Because
I know you face them a lot, so it's...
Yeah, I love it. A lot of my friends over there, I'm about to head over there and talk to them in a second, just you know, get my hellos in, and it's good to see those guys, and it's good to compete against them. You know, I've been competing with them for 2 years, and then flipping, now I'm pitching against them, and it's been fun. You know, I think I've only seen him a couple times this year, but you know, I'm always excited to pitch against those guys. It's just, like I said, it's fun competing against the guys you've been competing with for 2 years. So.
Sure.
Hope I get the chance tonight.
Now, what's the biggest challenge with adjustments to the hitter? Now, I know you've been in the Central League both of your years here, so this is probably an old question from before when I wanted to talk to you, but how do you adjust to the approaches here?
Yeah, it took a little bit getting used to at first. Like you said, the approach is a little bit different from back home. But now I'm lucky enough to have been in the Central League for 3 years, like you said, and I've seen a lot of these guys a lot. And with the exception of the Tigers, who I haven't pitched against a lot, all the other teams I've seen a good amount of times. So I've kind of got used to it. But yeah, at first it was just the approaches were a little bit different. You know, I think a lot of longer at bats here. Some guys will really grind you out when you get to 2 strikes. And, you know, it's just kind of getting used to how to attack that when, you know, it seems like there's no way they can ever make contact with this pitch, and then they just foul it off.
Yes.
You got to figure out how to, you know, counter that. So it's all a, you know, it's a work in progress. It's still going on.
It never ends.
Yeah.
It never ends. I know. Yeah. That's the part of competing. Now, last question. How do you communicate with the coaches over here as opposed to the ones with the Lions? And I know there's a lot of – someone told me a long time ago, one of the former pitchers here, there's a lot of meetings with the Giants, more so than the other team.
I'd say about the same amount of meetings. We both have, you know, a lot of scouting report meetings. We go over every team before we play them every time. But the communication in both places has been really good. You know, I, of course, get a lot of help from my translators, and, you know, they're pretty transparent on everything as far as, you know, matchups, roles in both places. And I wouldn't say in my half a year with the Giants that we've had any more meetings than we did in my previous spot.
Okay.
But it's just, you know, I just got to give all the thanks to my translators all the time. I tell them all the time I'd be lost without you guys. Just all the stuff we go through, the scouting report meetings and stuff, I'd just be lost without somebody telling me what's going on. So I appreciate them very much, I'll tell you that.
All right, well, we're glad you found a good place to be in the
yes.
Tokyo Dome. So
yes,
good luck the rest of the way.
Thank you very much.
All right, appreciate it.
Okay, so Jim, what did you think?
I really enjoyed that, and I'll tell you for a couple of reasons why. It reminded me, not like I needed reminding in a week when there's so much change going on, about how much we human beings really, really want things we can rely on, that we don't have to think about, that
yes.
are routine. And yeah, you know, like the grass. Oh, it doesn't bother me, but it kind of does. You know, it's at some microscopic level. And it made me think about how, you know, not only how we go through our lives, and I'll tell you a little tiny story about that, but how it must be for to some degree, all of our lives are about being able to repeat certain things, repeat processes, how we do mm-hmm. our work, how we take care of our children, how we approach other people. You know, in public who are troublesome
mm-hmm.
or friendly or whatever. You know, we have these responses, and so much we want things to be predictable so that we can eliminate the random, you know, the random weirdness. And but if you're, you know, for me, that means, you know, getting my stories out or getting my work done. But for if you're a baseball player or you're an athlete, where everything is about repeating a very refined physical motion.
Mm.
And then you give this person a different kind of dirt under his feet, a different shape of the mound he's throwing off of.
Sure.
A different texture to the infield. A different mm-hmm. color to the infield, different kinds of balls, and not even to mention the human component, the umpires and the stadiums and all that. It makes me glad I'm not a professional baseball player, because I don't know if I could handle it. But I thought that was really interesting. And it, I think it puts into light, I see this with pitchers in particular, because they have so many variables, you know, especially, you know, the ball is different and the mounds are different and the parks are different and the bullpens are different and everything's sure. different. I mean, of course, Japan has moved a great deal, you know, took that huge leap forward in 2011 to actually use the same balls.
Mm-hmm. Huge leap, yeah.
And all teams would use the same ball. And we, you know, shout out to Tony Barnett for his explaining his nightmare that he was going to the mound and he'd been practicing with a ball that wasn't going to be used in that game.
yes.
So I really appreciate, you know, how he handled those questions. You know, it's not an adjustment. It is an adjustment, but it's not. And I certainly get it. It's not a big thing. But these guys are masters of small things. And it just mm-hmm. leaves me in awe. But as far as I think the teammates and pitching for the Giants and Tigers, I think we'll get to the bit about the Tigers and his situation being weird, being confusing, and his exit. I'll get to that in a minute after you're done. But I thought that was interesting, and pitching against one's teammates. I think it changes. It's really a modern society thing, because, you know, when I was a kid and before free agency, when players had no rights and mm-hmm. teams could cut them and dispose of them as they liked.
Sure.
Players tended to dislike their opponents on other teams. It was part of the thing. I mean, rival teams really disliked each other. There were fights. You know, people got hurt in fights. Mm. People, bat players knocked each other over because you had to win so you didn't get cut. In free agency, when players have rights, it's added a level. I know there are old people who say, you know, baseball shouldn't be civilized. You know, it should be combat. It should be a contact sport. But that's just not our society anymore. And the idea, you know, how do you like pitching against your former team? I love it because they're my friends. These guys are friends because they're all professionals. What baseball has gained and what the world has gained is empathy. Mm. Empathy for one's competitors. And I think that's a healthy thing. Anyway, that's enough philosophizing from me. Your comments?
Well, I'm thinking that was the thing for me that stood out. I mean, I did the story and I wrote about other things, but I thought, I pictured myself, right, playing basketball for all those years. And I did actually play against some of my former teammates in the sense that we went through a 3-on-3 tournament and we split our team in two. And we had a, you know, A team and a B team. And I was on the B team and we met in the final. And of course, we got on the court and we thought, well, this is really what we drove all this way to do. It was a 3-on-3 tournament. So this is really what we all drove here to do, was to play each other in the final. But it feels weird. You know, I'm a competitor. I know my guys on the other side want to beat us and they're the A team. So they really want to beat us.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't feel like, I always played with a kind of chip on my shoulder. I was always angry at the other guys. I was angry at the referees. I was just angry on the court. I'm a different guy when I get on the court. So anyway, I know I'm fun and fun loving and rainbows and sunshine and all that stuff on the podcast, but I can be really surly on the court. And apparently I always thought I was being really nice and asking Mr. Referee, why would you make such a call? But everyone seemed to think that I was shouting. Everyone heard it as shouting. I don't get it.
I've been there when I've been out of control.
What are you talking about? I wasn't out of control.
Okay.
Why would you suggest such a thing?
When others perceive one as being out of control. And
you sound like all those other people.
I know. I'm talking about me. I apologize. I'm talking about me.
Okay. Okay,
and,
good.
And the time somebody... somebody thought I was going to punch somebody at the WBC.
Oh, oh my word, no.
Back to the 2006 WBC, I think I felt like I was about to come to blows with the Secretary General of the KBO in San Diego. And, and in Anaheim, a few days earlier, our colleague Rob Small thought I was going to deck Jim Small.
Yeah, see, I can't imagine. And so my point being, if you're playing against the other players, I don't know. This sounds another thing like code speak to me in that, yeah, I wanted to compete against the guys I competed with before. But what I really wanted to do was get back at the team for having this not work out for whatever reason it was. You know, the team didn't want him back or didn't whatever. However, it worked. It worked out being the way it worked out. For whatever reason, he wants to get the team back. Now, you know, the other guys on the team just become opponents, you know, player, not my teammate, you know, player A, not my teammate, player B, not my teammate. But the team and seeing the uniforms and seeing and looking up and knowing somewhere or looking around and seeing somewhere that there's a GM or somebody who's the face of the team as an owner or whatever that person, a front office person or somebody who maybe told you a little white lie a long time ago or a trainer who didn't wrap your tape the right way and made you feel uncomfortable in a game. I mean, any reason to pick on the other team and see them as more of an enemy. And so I don't know what this was, but I couldn't go out there and look at the other guys and want to beat their heads in because that wasn't my nature. Not if I played with, you know, a team or anything. And even if I had played with some guys, I just want to win. It doesn't matter. I don't change.
Right.
You know, I don't go out there and say, oh, today I want to beat these guys because I used to play alongside them or because the manager made me mad or something like that. I want to beat everybody's head in. So it really, I don't care where you came from, what your background is, what your story is, what you did to me before and all that. There's no, I want to win more. So I'm wondering what that was about and that, you know, that that kind of discussion because we're all built differently. So I'm not saying that there's anything to it, but I want to know more about that because it was interesting. What did you hear when you heard that?
Well, what I heard, as soon as you mentioned it, I heard two things. One is I heard that this happens more with the Hanshin Tigers than it used to happen a lot with Hiroshima Carp because it was definitely about money. For those of you who are maybe for the few of you who are less initiated, the Hiroshima Carp for decades, basically two things you need to know about them is they claimed never to have, they have not lost money, I think, as an organization since like 1952.
Wow.
They've been in the black every single year. Now they do this basically by their licensing acumen and selling everything that isn't nailed down and putting a player's name on it. You know, the Kenta Maeda t-shirt, you know, the t-shirts, you know, if, when Marty Brown picked up he copied the pirate when Lloyd McClendon, I think it when he was managing the Pirates, not before he managed Seattle, he had an argument with an umpire and pulled a base out of the field and chucked it.
Yes, I remember.
And Marty Brown did that. And so the next day the Carp merchandise store was selling t-shirts and all the players were wearing it. It says my manager throws bases.
I remember that instance as well.
Yeah, so that's what they did. Everything.
Oh, Lloyd McClendon. That's a name. That's a blast from the past.
So
especially with the Little League World Series going on right now, because he was a Little League World Series mega hero. Yeah.
My goodness.
Yeah.
And so the Carp survived by selling stuff and by not paying their players what they were worth. So for every player, it was always, well, we know you're worth more, but, you know, we're the Carp, so tough. Which is why when free agency came, the Carp dynasty crashed like, you know, it crashed like nobody's business. So anyway, so that was the thing with the carp. But the tigers have always been have a mixed message machine. And I'm going to tell you the story of Ryan Vogelsong. Now, as some of you remember, Ryan Vogelsong was a minor league, major league, up and down guy, came to Japan, had a modicum of success in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
The Tigers one year said, we don't want you for next year. Early on, because the teams are required by the union, not with the import players, but with the unionized players. In the unionized Japanese players, they're required to tell them in the middle of September whether they expect them to be back next year.
Sure.
Okay. So they told Ryan that he was not in their plans for the following season. And so he started making plans. And then 2 minutes after the off season began, the Tigers started calling him and saying, hey, don't make plans to join another team. We still may want you back.
Okay.
And he told me when he joined Oryx that I had to tell them what part of I don't ever want to play for your team again. Don't you understand? But that's the thing with the Tigers. They are a mixed message machine. They tell you they're run by people who are in some degree in fear of how every move is perceived. Now I understand that because I tend to be a fearful person, but it's not a good look. You know, it lacks the confidence, it lacks the whole thing, and people who depend on you to be reliable get annoyed. And so certainly can see that happening with Kyle Keller. Like they probably spent September saying, oh, we might want you back next year. And he's thinking, let's see, my kids want to come. My family wants to come back to Japan, but I don't know if I'll have a job. Should I start looking? Should my agent be looking for work in America?
Yeah. You know? I mean, might. Yeah, no. People don't work on might, so I agree with him. But yeah, mixed messages is one thing, but that seems unfair to me. That seems against the rules. If you tell a player once that you are not, he's not in your plans for the following season, then immediately he should be free to negotiate with other teams, and you should not be able to contact him again in that manner. In my opinion,
well, yeah,
that's not fair.
Well, teams do. I mean, there are great stories about players who were out of jobs, but by my favorite one, which I will not relate, a player was out of a job and looked like he was going to be working at a convenience store until suddenly a player left. The guy declared free agency used to be very late in the game. Used to be able to declare free agency very, very late, like in the very end of December, and suddenly he's gone, and that team, the Dai Hawks, then I think were out of options, and so this guy was going to be working at a convenience store to support his wife and two kids, and suddenly he's with the Hawks, and he becomes an all-star. So
gotcha.
Great things can happen. Yeah, great things can happen, but I certainly get the team bit. So,
yeah,
interesting. So thank you so much for that.
Yeah. And thank you, Kyle, for essentially stepping in. And like I said, I don't usually discuss who I would normally, who I was going after. And I can't remember because we did have some technical issue again this week, but we have a backup going on. And so we should be able to get this one out. But I think in the first intro, I did discuss that the fact that I was looking for Foster Griffin this particular moment, and that I did talk to Ilier Hernandez, and this was I don't know if it was the fourth time or the fifth time. They're getting, you know, I'm getting old and they're starting to run together, but I went up to Mr. Hernandez before the game. I said, hey man, it's, you know, it's been like the four times now, man, isn't this going to be the charm? And he gave me a very hearty maybe. So I you know, when you go out to these things, and again, you don't know who you're going to be able to talk to and who's going to say yes. And I prepare questions ahead of time for guys on both sides. I sometimes grab a guy who I didn't expect to talk or have an interview with, and that was the case with Kyle, and I just made do, but he did give us some good information. I did enjoy the chat and do appreciate him stopping, and it was good because he's one of the guys who I met when he was with the Tigers, and I said, you know, we don't get down to the Kansai area. We don't have an opportunity to talk to you very often. We would love to have you on the show, and we finally were able to make it happen, so I'm really glad.
Okay.
All right, let's go rocking with Roki. So obviously I'm in the States, and if I choose to get up at crazy hours, which jet lag will do with you, and have the consciousness and wherewithal to turn on a computer and look for a game, I can watch it, but none of that was going on this particular trip, so I didn't see much of this game on Thursday night. But I did hear about a little bit about it, and I did see the highlights of the game, but they only showed that Noki Sasaki went 1 1/3 innings. I don't think they just mentioned that something happened to him. So I didn't really get much out of this in terms of anything. They lost the game eventually 6-1 to the Nippon Ham Fighters. Sasaki did not come away with a loss, even though he gave up a runner and, again, went 1 1/3 innings. But you tell me what you saw, and you can give us the numbers too, because I didn't even really have anything to do with this game. I just don't think he hit a batter, so that's good.
No, he did not, but I guess it was karma. Batter hit him.
And hashtag
high. I love it.
Yeah, karma. Karma's been big this past month or so. I mean, we had the woman who's trying to get Jingu Stadium plowed under, had a stress fracture in her ankle throwing out a first pitch at Jingu.
Yeah, the good old avulsion fracture in the knee. Yeah, yes, the avulsion, yes.
Yeah. So then Roki Sasaki was tagged on the ankle by a comebacker that smacked him just above the ankle, and it looked bad, but he went off the field for treatment. It was the fifth batter he'd faced. He'd retired all four, the first four batters he faced, and he was looking good. And then he was helped off the mound. He went back for treatment. He came back to the mound, threw some warm-up pitches, and the team said, no, let's just, you know, what do you expect, Roki Sasaki? The team's going to go, you know, you got a dent there, son. Let's be careful. You know, he's their prize. So they took him out, and he was not deactivated. He went with the Marines to Fukuoka, where he practiced and ran. He ran on Friday, so he was apparently okay. Unfortunately, because he was in Fukuoka, he had to witness that massacre.
Yeah, which I did see the highlights. I just saw the score.
The Friday night massacre with more home runs from Hotaki Yamakawa and Tatsuro Yanagimachi. They were kind of on a roll this week, and they had some left over after they beat the tar out of the Cebu Lions on Thursday.
Yikes.
So that was that for Roki Sasaki, but apparently he will be pitching. Manager Masato Yoshi told us on Friday that he expects him to be back within 6 or 7 days. Of course, mind you, the last time Roki Sasaki was deactivated, Yoshi said he would not be back later than 2 weeks, and it was closer to 6 weeks.
You know, I hate to bring this up, but there have been some rumblings about some coaches and some managers not quite being truthful or bending or twisting or mangling the truth in some cases. Do you think we're getting a lot of the actual reports out of Chiba land, or are they just blowing smoke at anybody who comes up and asks questions? Because it doesn't seem like it's congruent.
Congruent
with reality.
As I alluded to before, when Masato Yoshi was the Fighters pitching coach and Shohei Ohtani in 2000, he was one of two Fighters pitching coaches. Every team's got two. Mm-hmm. And he was one of the Fighters pitching coaches when Shohei Ohtani was coming back from his whatever blister or cramp or hangnail or whatever it was in 2016 that had him beat the Fighters, winning the best designated hitter and the best pitcher award and the Pacific League MVP. He was very sly about when Sasaki would be fit to come back. But he's, and the story is complicated because the Fighters wanted, when Shohei Ohtani was coming back, the Fighters wanted Shohei Ohtani to get a chance to just hit regularly, because every time they had a magic button that year, they'd push a button and a reliever would come out of the bullpen and become a quality starter. It was like magic, you know. It's like push the button, here comes one guy who hasn't started in 4 years, and bingo, you know, he's quality start. Oh, we need another guy, bingo. And Shohei Ohtani was just happily munching, you know, destroying baseballs as the DH. And Masato Yoshii would report on his bullpen to the reporters at Tokyo Dome when I was there one day, and said, yeah, he's not quite ready yet. You don't ever quite know. I find Yoshii to be relatively straightforward, but Sasaki's situation is pretty unique because of all the MLB stuff in the background.
Yeah, I understand. It's shrouded in whatever it's shrouded in. I'm just wondering because I'm thinking they...
Yeah, we call it BS, some people.
Yeah, some people. I can't go there because we haven't been out there. They haven't told me anything. I like to look at them, watch their mannerisms, how they deliver messages, and I'm not able to do that, so I can't make that judgment. I'm just thinking there's a lot more smoke coming out of Chiba than there is in the Dragons.
Yoshii is fairly transparent. When you see in the words, you can't tell, but when you watch his facial expression, sometimes he'll say things to you that make perfect sense on one level, and he'll be looking out the side. he'll be giving side eye to something, just to, you know, he rolling his eyes while he says it. And I think that was the feeling I got every time he talked about Shohei Ohtani when he was with the Fighters. He's telling you, this is the story that I have to tell you, but it's not the real story. I have to talk to my colleague who covers the Lotte Marines, but the case here.
Well, it was the same thing that when I sat down with Yoshii to talk about the handkerchief prince, Yuki Saito. He had a great start to his season. And I said, what's going on? And Yoshii said, he looked me in the eye and said, right? What is going on? I have no idea.
Yeah, that was, and this is a guy who basically caused Yoshii to quit the Fighters the first time. Because he had a manager who thought, the first time, because he had a manager bomb, who thought Yuki Saito was going to be, you know, the next thing, the next best thing to camembert cheese. Now they're in Hokkaido after all. So, and it turned out it was Hideki Kuriyama's pipe dream. Yoshii tried to tell him that, and he wouldn't listen, so he left.
Yeah. Well, again, we expect Sasaki to be back again, but soon again. But this is weird, and he didn't. I mean, there's really not much statistically to talk about. He just wasn't out there long enough. We didn't get enough of the sample size, ha ha ha, in this game to really talk about anything. But and the Marines, I want to throw this in there just because we haven't talked about the races in a while because we've been. Mired in other things when we had technical difficulties mostly, but I'm quite surprised that they are as persistently hanging around in this position as they are. I didn't expect that from them. Of course, I didn't expect the Buffaloes to be 8 games under 500 at this point in the season. Mm-hmm. And while I did expect the Lions to be the last place team, I didn't expect things to be this blood on the walls, gray matter, ugly.
yeah, that's, you can't paint a more accurate picture of Sabu's season than that.
we see gray matter.
We do indeed. Sure.
So, and I'm genuinely disappointed in the Buffaloes because I think they are the enigma that is Shunpeita Yamashita. Mm. You know, what is going on? This doesn't look like it's supposed to.
So for next week, we'll get a look at that. He's supposed to have figured things out on the farm for the second time, and mm-hmm. he's going to start today, Sunday. So we'll see what that looks like.
Okay. And again, the Eagles, over 30s, underperformers. That's what I expected to have that team. And this team, I think, has played more around 500, more above 500 than below. But now that team has dropped a little bit below 500. So, yeah, it's no surprise to me. The fighter that I kept saying last season, I like the talent on the team. And to see this team in second place, 10 games over as we speak now, is really not a surprise to me. In fact, I even have higher expectations. What I didn't see coming was what I think a lot of people didn't see coming, and that's Shun Mizutani, who's having a breakout season. And that is a boost. You get all the players who can hit, the Gunji. Yuya Gunji, who broke in with the Dragons. They all raved about how this guy was a hitter. He was more of a hitter than a catcher, and the Dragons couldn't figure out a way to use him. And he's thriving in a semi part time role as just being a guy who hits.
Don't feel bad. I mean, every team has those guys. Not every team, but most teams have those guys who they just they're down on for the wrong reasons.
Mm-hmm.
And they let them go, and then they've got a sore spot on the one side of their head where they keep hitting themselves for letting them go. I mean, the Dragons happen to be, they're probably the worst in Japan, but they're not the only ones. They're not the only ones. The Bay Stars, probably every time they play the Dragons, saying, what is it with Seiya Hosokawa that we didn't see? And you just look at it, and the Giants going, Takasta Taguchi, 31 saves? What's up with that? We gave that guy away.
Yeah.
So it happens. It happens. It's normal. And it's normal because even people who are steeped in baseball, And I'm far less knowledgeable than these people are, think they know far more than they do. They think, this is not, they confuse information with knowledge. they see numbers and they say, oh, this is never gonna, you're never gonna have something like this with a quality player. And then that guy who was never gonna turn out to be a quality player ever suddenly wins a best nine award with a Rock 10. So,
well, I don't see that happening. Yeah. I don't see that happening with Toshiki Abe, but
but he was a good player, and
he's a decent player. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. He was a reliable player with the Dragons. He's not he's not a gold glove infielder, but he's a reliable, he has a consistently good approach. He's got a little pop. I always liked him, and I like him more now that the first time we met this year, he said, wow, your Japanese is really good. And this is something I never hear when I'm in the ballpark with John, except when people are talking to John.
Thank you, kind sir.
I'll get home and the wife will say, how come your Japanese is really bad compared to John's?
Oh, gosh.
So yeah, thank you, Toshiki Abe, for the boost of confidence.
Yes, thank you. And yeah, thank you for the boost of confidence as well, sir.
So, yeah. All right. The players. Oh, it's the Nippon Ham Fighters.
Okay.
Sure. Yeah. And the last thing is I did want to mention that, last year, murder suicide king, murder suicide manager Tsuyoshi Shinjo.
Mm-hmm.
He went through a phase where Suicide Squeeze, you know, it's like it was like revisiting his introductory press conference when he told the media that he was the only one who understood how to score runs without hits.
Oh,
and that his team would be successful once he taught his players this secret. You know,
burn him.
I mean, when, you know, I wondered what
where do you
guy,
get off?
I know it's like, what was he, you know, what was he doing motivational speaking when he was in Bali telling people how, you know, how they could become billionaires by writing their underwear off their taxes or something?
Oh my gosh.
So, sorry, I stole that line from Bill James, but. You know, it was just weird. It was like, I know this. And anyway, so last summer, a week last summer in June, he tried three suicide squeezes. He did it once against the Hawks, and the Hawks saw it coming and they pitched out and the guy was dead on arrival, literally. Oh, not literally, but figuratively. And mm-hmm. then a couple of days later, he did it with the Marines on consecutive pitches. And bang, bang, out at home, out at home. Well, he did it the other day, and it took the Marines completely by surprise.
Yeah, sometimes it can work.
Yeah.
Didn't he do it on back-to-back pitches, I think?
He did. He did.
Yes.
And this was like...
I saw the highlight, and they mentioned
that. I think this was Wednesday. And it might have been Thursday. It might have been the Roki Sasaki game. But it was quite impressive. And the squeeze bunts were absolutely amazing, really hard. I mean, below the strike zone. And
yes.
give credit
Yeah, they were
to,
not easy pitches to get the bat on.
No,
yes.
and give credit to Tatsuki Shimizu
mm-hmm.
and Torai Fushimi for getting those bunts down. So
yes.
Just loved it, and I dislike all the routine sacrifices, but I love a bunt. I love a good bunt. You know, it's artistry. It's skill. And
well, I'll tell you about this. Is when I heard, you know, I was watching the highlight, and I heard the announcer say that you know he did this on back to back, at least with back to back batters, and I thought this is one of the reasons we'll never see this in the major leagues because. Thinking ahead, you know, I think he thought if I get the first one, I'm going to do the second one.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if I don't get the first one, I'll let it, the next guy swing. But because he got the first one, he's like, well, let's get the second run in. You know, one run is better than two, and this is a good way to get it in. And this just would never happen in Major League Baseball. I'm not saying it's better or it's worse. I'm just saying it wouldn't happen. You know, it just what they don't think that way in the major leagues. So you're not going to see it.
Yeah.
And I think that's exciting to get those two runs the way they did it. And it pumps up your players.
It is fun. And I was reminded yesterday by how much I enjoy watching watching sports in general. But the fun play yesterday was a Dragons pinch runner scoring from second on an infield single.
Oh.
And... Basically,
I've not seen the highlights yet.
Okay. Basically, it was runners on second and third, two outs. And I'm trying to remember who smoked the ball to a shortstop and deep in the hole. And the ball came off the glove, and the shortstop had to scramble for it. But the shortstop, Seiya Kinami, didn't scramble. He scrambled for it. Properly alertly, but when he picked up the ball, he didn't do it and threw it in. He didn't do it with the urgency that he would have had if he had actually watched what the base runner was doing.
Uh-huh.
Because by the time he threw it probably was only after he released it that he saw the runner was already sprinting towards home.
And the
ball,
I see.
He threw a little routine ball to Teruaki Sato, who I think saw the runner at the same time he saw the ball and kind of fumbled it a little bit because he couldn't believe it.
Yeah, well, you know? I don't trust the Sato arm, but that's another story.
No, but he didn't have a play. By the time he had control of the ball, he didn't have a play. But he would have had a play if, you know, there would have been a play if they had been ready for it. But the guy was fast and he was off like a shot. And since nobody expected it, they weren't ready. And I look, you know, it often doesn't work, but surprise is a wonderful thing, and it was a fun thing, and that one that allowed the Dragons. Now, they didn't win the game; it ended up in a 5-5 tie, but they were losing by 2 runs in the ninth inning against Suguru Iwazaki, and they got the tying run on that pinch run, that daredevil pinch run. So credit to the pinch runner.
Well, yes, and I would imagine at any point, at any position Sato is on the field, that they're running on him. If he's in the outfield, we're running. If he's at third base and you have a chance to score from second, we're going. I mean,
well, you know,
I just don't think they trust his arm.
Well, there was a interesting story. In my line of work, I get to see the drafts that the Japanese language sports department are writing when they first chuck them in the folder, in the editing folder.
Mm-hmm.
And I was reading about how at Tokyo Dome the other day, the Tigers, Sato had made an error, a costly error one game. And so the next day he was out taking extra fielding.
Which always helps, right? Yeah, that always
it makes doesn't it hurt, better. But it didn't help him get in the lineup the next day.
Yeah,
he didn't get. He was sitting on the bench. Came on as a pinch hitter that game. So
yeah. All right. Well, I think the book is run on him. Make him throw it because you will get some mistakes. Anyway, let's move along. Let's go to fielding questions. All right. This email came from our buddy Glenn in Tokyo, whom we have never met. We got to meet one day, dude. Somehow, let me know when you're going to your next game. Maybe I'll stop by on my way home if it's at Tokyo Dome or something. Mm. But anyway, he says, thanks as always for the fabulous pod. It makes my Monday commute so much more bearable. How bad is it? An article in today's Japanese newspaper about sending home an Olympic gymnast for smoking. And you can see the time stamp on this email. It made me wonder if it is still as prevalent as it once was in MPB. With you chaps hanging out at various shadowy parts of the stadiums, you probably see it more than most. Also interested in your thoughts on what Yakult is doing wrong to find itself looking up at Chunichi. Or is it too soon to look at the standings, John? Loved the Yomiuri OB, the old-timers game versus Hanshin old-timers game the other night. That was classic stuff, he says. So, Jim, the smoking.
The smoking, yeah. That
smoking
was,
and the bandit.
Yeah, well... As for I resent the comment that I hang out in shadowy areas of ballparks.
He just means the sunlight doesn't hit all the time.
No, what I want to tell him is that essentially the shadowy part of the ballpark is the part that follows me around wherever I go. that's where stuff happens.
Because the brim of your hat. Oh no, shady
no,
stuff happens there.
Shady, no, I that goes with the keeping it on the lowdown, man.
So, gotcha.
No, I don't know it's as prevalent, but I don't have any reason to believe it's changed. The teams are doing better at hiding the places. Of course, now the teams are keeping the players away from the reporters.
Correct.
So it's really hard to tell. Cebu, of course, was the famous place where they had the visiting players' smoking room. It wasn't the visiting player. It was a smoking room. The grounds crew and reporters used it as well, I believe. Just when you went onto the field via the camera, the photographer's pit there.
Mm-hmm.
And you the Hawks players, when before they went out to practice, they would take each would take their smokers would take their cigarettes and their lighter, go in, have a puff, and then leave their cigarette and their lighter, the lighter stacked on top of their cigarette, their pack of cigarettes. And there'd be usually 5 or 6, 7 packets of cigarettes there on the step leading down the little shallow step.
What years are we talking about here?
Oh, until they remodeled the stadium during just before COVID. The smoking room is still there, but I haven't seen the packs of cigarettes on the step anymore. The step, this whole area underneath the the behind home plate stands at Sabo, as you know, has all been re-dug out and turned into a like an office complex.
Mm-hmm.
It used to just be like stairs down and one hallway behind each dugout. So now it's a quite complex maze of offices and rooms. But the smoking room is still there behind the photographer's section. It's just not as visible. You don't see the players in there puffing away. So I don't know. I really don't know, but I don't have any reason to think it's gotten better. It's still a thing in high school sports. It's still a thing in that, you know, they're not supposed to be smoking, but it's one of the things that the players do to be cool.
Gosh, that is not cool. Well, Glenn, I took the kids to that game that you're talking about, where the old timers game. That was the game we went to. So that was 7:15, and I think I wore my Dragons jersey to that game because I didn't want to have a Tigers one, and I don't have any Giants paraphernalia. So I just wore Dragons, and I bumped into a guy who was a Dragons fan, and he and his family, and they said, "Dragons!" And I said, "Yay!" And we kind of cried as we walked away from each other. He shed a tear, but
I hear that.
Yeah. So, but I, you know, the term as it used to be is kind of an indefinite period for me, Glenn. And I'm just thinking, what time frame are we talking? And so I'm thinking, for me, my reference I'm going to offer is the past 10 years. And my answer would be it has lessened because I don't smell as much smoke as I used to. But that might be because some of the managers who were smokers are fewer and fewer as well. Because you will remember this, Jim, when Nabe Q, who I think has stopped smoking because I don't smell the smoke when I go out to say we don't.
Well,
maybe he's just smoking in a different room. Yeah, maybe he's smoking in a different area. He was a big smoker, and then surprisingly, Kazuo Matsui was a big smoker, and I didn't smell the smoke when he was out there. Perhaps he's gotten wiser in his age as he gains wisdom. Let's put it that way, instead of numbers on the back end of the whatever the front end of your number is, some wisdom on the backside in terms of number of years, but. The younger players who are coming up to replace older ones, I think they don't suck on cancer stick as much.
But yeah, I think that's probably true.
But I'm just dumbfounded. How come we cannot stop smoking as a society? Our young people coming up now should never, ever want to touch anything like that. They learn how bad it is for their health. They see the effects. We talk about it. And yet we can't stop young people from smoking. It just, it's perpetual, this issue. I'm dumbfounded. This is, you know, obviously year four of us not being allowed free access in and around the normal areas of Tokyo Dome, as well as the shady areas. And I don't think we can say for sure, but it just seems like there's less of it. And it seems like we should not have this at all. You know, that the only people who should be smoking in our society by now are people 50 years and older who just grew up with it. And the others, I don't understand. You know, when I see young people with a cigarette, I'm like, how did you get into this? Who would allow you to do this? And I'm only assuming that they're smoking in the family, and that's just an accepted practice, and so that it doesn't stop that way. But I don't even know why we sell cigarettes anymore. It's just
because the same reason everything is done, to make money, to profit off of other people's poor judgment. I mean, this it's a long story, don't need to get into it, but yeah, that is so true.
I'm perplexed.
And it is amazing. But yeah, I thought the whole thing with the Olympics was very wild. And the funniest thing about the Olympics, the last thing is that it points out the whole thing was covered as this was the athlete's, the athlete decided to quit because she had been found out to have smoked and drank during training in Tokyo before going to Paris. And she was underage, and nobody, you know, it was something. Okay, so that was the story. She did not appear at the press conference. but a lawyer did.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, which was interesting. So a lawyer's there. The person was not there to confirm the story. And all, I would say, without exception, now, as a reporter, as somebody who's required to put out stories, all I could do was put out the stories that were put, you know, the information that was put out in front of me. I can't assume anything. But sure. Japanese observers on social media, it seemed like nobody was buying the idea that it was her idea. Nobody was buying the idea that this woman who was supposedly so stressed out and had been having some discipline issues, but was named captain of the team and is going to her first Olympics as the captain of Japan's women's gymnastics team, suddenly decided, well, I've disgraced Japan. I'm going home. I don't need to compete in the Olympics.
Right.
Pretty much nobody was buying that because everybody on Twitter was saying this is a terrible decision, not by the athlete, but by the Gymnastics Federation. Or this was a great decision by the Gymnastics Federation. And this is what we call, what in Japanese language is known as tatemae, or this is how it was interpreted, that the whole story about her, it being her decision, was a lie meant to cover mm-hmm. up. Don't ask, don't tell situation. We don't want to talk about it, so we're going to say it was her decision, and we're going to leave it at that. But everybody's going to know it was a lie,
right?
And now this happens in a lot of things in Japanese society. It's basically a systemized practice of white lies, a transparent white lies. Everybody knows you're lying, and everybody knows that the message is either we're lying because we want to present the proper face on this situation, or we don't want to talk about it. So when you detect somebody telling you a bald-faced lie in Japan, they're doing it not to make fun of you, but to say enough questions.
Yeah, and don't probe. Don't probe afterward. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And that's kind of part of the song and dance, right?
So the Japanese interpreted the woman quitting as she was forced out, but don't ask why.
Right. Okay. And then Glenn, as for Yakult having the combination of injuries and spotty performances that had that team looking up at the Dragons of all teams, I just think it's mostly the simplest explanation I offered up at the beginning of the season in the prediction show is starting pitching. They don't have enough of it. The Swallows brought in to the season some of the same guys we've seen in the past. And of course, Masanori Ishikawa, whom we like and we know Tony Barnett adores. But
well, he's been good. Actually,
but he's not a frontline starter.
No, he's not. He's a once every 12 days starter.
Maybe once a month. I just, you know, and then they brought in some guys who started out well, but they haven't been able to sustain and carry that and make that a whole season's worth of success at the moment. And every team has its share of injuries, and Yakult is suffering in that respect as well. But some guys have come on and picked up here and there, and they've won some games, but they're not sustainable in terms of competing. And they obviously, they won the series with the Dragons, but could have easily lost all three, could have won all three.
Great series.
It was a fun series to watch. But, that's the struggles of teams that are not winning. And I'm not saying they're bad. They have aspects that are good. It's just not turning into wins. It's not turning into success.
As I mentioned to you before we started recording, I spent my free time the past 3 weeks sorting through 5 years of HTML files
mm-hmm.
of every Japanese pro baseball game. I should say every Central League and Pacific League game. I don't do the minors because there isn't much data available. But and one of the things I noticed from my first, the data starts to clarify, is I revisited what happens with first strikes. And I wrote about this in my blog yesterday. And one of the things I noticed is that the Yomiuri Giants are no longer the king of first called first strikes. It's now the Yakult Swallows.
And as far as their pitchers.
as far as their pitchers, correct. Their pitchers are the best team in Japan at getting called for strikes. But the reason they're the best, there's an obvious reason why they're the best at getting called for strikes. And that's because they throw more pitches in the strike. They throw more first pitches in the strike zone. That's what the Swallows have been doing since, you know, in 2020, it was like their secret weapon. Nobody expected a Central League team to be doing this. But it's when you have a predictable pattern, it is hard to switch away from it. You know, it's good if your guys are throwing gas or they've got the nastiest stuff in the world, then yeah, go for the first strike and knock people out. But that really hasn't been the Swallows' thing. And they've had trouble maintaining that. They get the most swings on first strike pitches by far in NPB, and that's why they get the most called strikes, because of the most pitches in the strike zone. And I think that's hard to maintain with the quality of – it's hard to maintain, period. But they do need to move up a level, and they have not been able to succeed at that. And I think some of the pitchers are not happy with that. I know it fits some pitchers' thing, and they know it's the right thing to do, but sometimes the right thing to do is really hard.
Mm-hmm.
So
more impossible.
I think that is, yeah, it is. I mean, they want you to, I mean, pitching coach Tomohito Ito told me his goal is to have guys not only throw strikes, but change speeds within the strike zone so that they can keep, you know, have another way. It's not just, oh, this is going to be down the middle, but it's going to be much, it's going to look like the same pitch, but it's going to be quite a bit slower.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what his goal is. And I think they have been unable to implement that to the degree that team and the pitcher's abilities are. But I think they are on the right. It's always doing the right thing is never wrong, but sometimes it hurts like hell.
Sure.
So anyway, last thing before I do recommend you read that blog post. It's called First Strike Capability. And the other two conclusions are that there are three teams that are really good. Actually, there are four, but three teams that are really good at getting called for strikes. And they get them for three different reasons. One, Swallows, because they throw the ball in the strike zone.
Mm-hmm.
Two, because they're good at getting called. One team is good because they're just good at getting called strikes. I mean, they're really good. They get called strikes in every count.
What team is that?
That's the Nippon Ham Fighters.
Okay. And then the third?
And the third is the Yomiuri Giants. They're really not good at getting called strikes in any counts, except when it's the first pitch or a 1-0 count. Then they magically turn into the called strike masters.
Hashtag hi.
So, man, you know, it's weird. It's like there's two teams, you know how they got there. And there's one team that all you can think of is, well, we can't help the Giants by giving them good calls on 3-2 pitches and 3-0 pitches and 0-2 pitches. So we're going to help them out when nobody notices early in the count. And I really think that's what's going on. I think the whole umpire thing is we have to help the Giants, and we have to do it early in the count where people aren't going to notice.
When people aren't looking, yeah.
Exactly. Because everybody's
they don't care as much.
Everyone's going to complain if we're giving them all the called 3-2 strikes.
Yes. Yeah. People don't throw stuff at the TV for strike one.
No, exactly. And I think it's been something that's been going on for decades. So
okay.
And it's part of the Giants' success. So anyway, I talk about that data in the blog and how I came to that conclusion. So have a read.
All right. Appreciate the correspondence, Glenn. Hope to meet you soon sometime this year. Thank you very much. Anyone else who has a question, hit us up at JBWPodcast on X.com with the hashtag high heat. Send questions via email to yakyujohn@gmail.com or go to the Facebook page and leave us a message there. I'll be home next week at the end of the week, so I'll probably miss a bunch of more games, and then I'll be home on Friday and I'll try to look at some games, and then I go to the office Saturday and Sunday where I probably don't get to watch much baseball, but we'll put together a show anyway, and we will talk to you then. Enjoy your baseball.
See you at the ballpark.
Follow the hosts on Twitter at JBW Podcast and at JBall Allen. And feel free to submit your questions by email or tweet with hashtag High Heat. Thank you for listening to Japan Baseball Weekly.